movies, take a few notes.
It was fun. What's up, Goreheads, and welcome to another episode of Extreme Horror Replay Podcast. And again, if you remember a few weeks ago, by the time you hear this, it'll be quite some time ago, but I asked people for the most vile movie they could think of. Or not necessarily vile, but violent and disgusting, and essentially their favorite horror. And we got quite a few responses. On the phone with me as our second Insta-guest for this series, I have Tyler, who goes by the name of Obscure _ Horror on Instagram. Tyler, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
I'm doing good. We're kind of going through a little bit of a heat wave here in Michigan right now. It was like 120% humidity and just nasty warm this morning. So you're obviously a horror fan, as you know. I mean, you're on Instagram and your nickname is Obscure Horror.
Correct, yeah.
You know, very briefly, or as detailed as you want it, what originally got you into horror? I mean, we just talked and you're 19, so...
So, I got into horror at a very young age. I wasn't, you know, into it. I was mostly scared of it. It was around, I want to say I was in kindergarten when Bride of Chucky was on TV, and I watched about 5 minutes of it before I started crying and running away.
Okay.
And after that, I just had a fear for anything, you know, horror, scary related. Uh-huh. And I also had one vivid encounter. I don't know if you heard of, I want to say like 10 years ago, this thing called Scary Maze. That was big on the internet.
I think so, yeah. Seems
to like a maze where you have your clicker and you're controlling the guy and you hit the sides of the maze, then the girl from The Exorcist pops out in a loud scream.
Okay, yeah.
So, I don't know how I found this out, but it was like in third grade, and I did it, and let's just say I had vivid nightmares of that for years, and I refused to watch The Exorcist until about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So, really what drove me to eventually love horror is just, I guess you could say I wanted to conquer my fear, and then...
Okay.
When I finally got around to watching Child's Play series, I was like, like, what the hell was I so scared about?
Yeah, and it usually seems to go that way for a lot of people. They, you know, this whole time, I think it's almost fear of the unknown, maybe?
Right.
Okay, so you've gotten over your fear. Now, what would be your or at least your current favorite? What's your current favorite horror movie?
Current favorite horror movie?
Yeah.
I'd go with John Carpenter's The Thing.
Okay.
I really enjoy that just because of the, you know, the practical effects. John Carpenter does a wonderful job of that with the music score as well. And again, going to the fear of the unknown, like you don't know who's the alien or not, you can't trust anyone.
Yeah. I mean, and if you're gonna have a favorite, and real quick, did you say how long ago you got over your fear?
Been a while. I'd say a good 7-8 years ago. I got a grip of my fear.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, if you're gonna have a favorite, John Carpenter's The Thing is probably a good favorite to have.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay, and then this will be our last question for the intro. If you had to pick one way to off somebody, any actor or actress in any movie, whether it was yours or, you know, somebody else's, how would you do it?
Well, I pick either... I was thinking Bruce Campbell, but no, he's too much of a badass. I wouldn't do that to him. Probably do Kurt Russell, and honestly, he would go out a heroic way, like trying to save others.
Okay.
From some unknown, I wouldn't say identity, it could be anything, a monster, some unknown force or identity.
Any kind of unknown force, basically. All right. Well, that's cool then.
And I wouldn't say he kills off screen, but, you know, he kind of struggles and then, you know, pans off and he starts screaming and everyone's running away.
Okay.
Yeah, I give him a heroic death.
All right. Well, that's fair then. That's fair. So, okay, when I put the word out there for the, you know, the choice of movies, you decided on The House That Jack Built. So you decided on The House That Jack Built, which stars Matt Dillon, and is directed by Lars von Trier. What was it about this movie that made you pick it?
Well, to be honest, I could have picked another movie like 120 Days of... or Solo, or 120 Days of Sodom, but I haven't watched that, so I didn't want to pick it.
Okay.
But...
Well, to be fair, somebody else did, so we're...
Yeah, true.
We're doing that one soon.
Maybe after I hear that podcast, maybe I might get around to watching it.
Yeah, I've never seen it, so I don't know if I'm anxious or not.
Anyway, I chose House of Jack Bill. I watched it. What intrigued me was that... Well, number one, it was just... pure violence. Pure, yeah. I wouldn't go as far as saying sadistic, but, you know, Matt Dillon, he is playing a psychopath or a serial killer.
Right.
I guess it's like watching those serial killer documentaries. It's like, it can be real. Like, there's people that do messed up crap like that in the world.
Right. And
it's just, I guess you'd say the surrealism.
Well, the surrealism, I think, comes in from Lars von Trier, because if you've ever seen Antichrist or any of his, okay, I mean, you know the visuals that Trier or von Trier puts in his movies, you know, the talking fox. I mean, he's just kind of a goofy guy, almost, and he's very artistic with what he does, but he's like, there's so many subtleties and so many underlying meanings and hidden... you know, treasures in his movies, bunch of Easter eggs and stuff like that. So, and this movie definitely has it as well. And he even puts clips of his own movies in this movie, kind of as a way to maybe say, you know, I'm here to stay, or I don't know why he does his own movies in here. It's kind of goofy, actually.
I'm watching interviews with him. He's definitely something else, I'd say.
Okay.
Very misunderstood.
All right.
At times.
Yeah, and I think he's he has a lot of critics, some good, some bad, but I think for the most part, people think he's just really off the wall, and I think because of that, because of his artsiness and because of his kind of obscurity and his visuals and stuff like that, I think people think that he's almost too far out there in some regards, but he does it well.
Yeah, and I also think that's the... deal with the whole meaning of the movie. Like, the movie itself is very subjective, because watching the movie, you know, Matt Dillon's character, Jack, he's expressing art, but in his own way, because, you know, art is subjective. Art can be anything, and it's really up to the viewers or the creators, I guess you'd say, interpretation of the meaning of art.
And there is, well, I mean, obviously we'll get into it, but there's a lot to unpack in this movie. I mean, because, and it's a long damn movie. I did not realize it was 2.5 hours, and I just finished it literally like 20 minutes ago. I was not expecting 2.5 hours of a horror movie, or a, you know, murder suspense horror, or whatever it could be.
It was definitely a long one, and then B... uncut version, and then it only added like not even a minute.
Oh, okay. Well, I know they cut it probably due to violence, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm sure we'll get into that later. Some of the scenes were extended and were cut down because it's too violent.
Yeah. I don't know, man. What they did show was pretty graphic. But yeah, as we said, The House That Jack Built, released in 2018, directed by Lars von Trier, scores a 6.8 on IMDb. It stars Matt Dillon, and really nobody else of note. You probably recognize a lot of the characters. I mean, Uma Thurman's in it.
There is Uma Thurman, yeah. And there's one lady off of Men in Black.
Yes.
Like, her husband was that cockroach alien.
Yeah, right. You recognize her if you saw her. But yeah, I mean, it's just like a lot of, like, known actors, but you kind of really only know them if you see their face. I mean, obviously Uma Thurman, but she's really only in it for 10 minutes. The house that Jack built, 2018.
Your house is a fine little house, Jack.
Are you allowed to speak along the way? I was thinking there might be rules.
Let me put it this way. Very few make it all the way without uttering a word. But do carry on merrily, just don't believe you're going to tell me something I haven't heard before.
Oops, that was maybe a mistake.
What was maybe a mistake?
Me getting in this car with you. You might as well be a serial killer. Sorry, but you do kind of look like one.
Some people claim that the atrocities we commit in our fiction are those inner desires which we cannot commit in our controlled civilization. So they are expressed instead through our art. I don't agree. I believe heaven and hell are one and the same. The soul belongs to heaven and the body to hell. Think about all the things I've done in my life without in any way resulting in punishment.
I mean, we're going to run the plot, or I'll run the plot. You jump in whenever you see fit. You're the color commentator for this episode, and we're going to get to it right now. So, first thing you hear is a voiceover, Matt Dillon, and he's talking to somebody. Now, already I have some questions because he's talking to an unseen somebody throughout the entire movie. And you come to know the voice, the extra voice that's not Matt Dillon as, or not Jack, you come to know him as Verge. Now, towards the end of the movie, and I don't want to go that far ahead, but...
Yeah, we probably shouldn't.
Yeah, but
when I heard Verge, I kind of understood who it was, because I don't know if you've read the Divine Comedy.
No, I have not. So I guess when we get there, I'll give you what my take on it is. Because,
gotcha.
Like I said, so... But there's a title card, First Incident. Uma Thurman's character, and I think on IMDb she's just labeled as Lady One. She's stranded on the side of the road with a flat tire, and Jack pulls up in this old kind of a beater van. Not really a beater, I mean, it's a really nice van, but it's older, obviously. And he walks up to her, or he pulls up to her, and she immediately comes walking over to the driver's side window. She's explaining that, she's got a flat tire, her jack is broke, and that she can't get, she can't get her tire fixed. So Jack is immediately kind of put off by her attitude, because she's almost being like, she's being very forceful in her take me into town, give me some help kind of thing. And he's just trying to like brush her off, really. Eventually, Lady One convinces Jack to take her to a blacksmith so he can weld like a hook or something onto the jack.
I think it was the,
or the loop.
The handle part onto it so you can...
Yeah. So, I mean, what was your first take on Uma Thurman's character?
She definitely seemed more off than Matt Dillon's character, for sure.
Okay, see...
Like, if there's anything I would have suspected being a serial killer, it would have been her.
Well, right. The whole time they're in the van, she's constantly talking about how, oh, that was a mistake, I shouldn't have got in because I don't know you from, you know, Joe Blow. You could be a serial killer and I'd never know it. But again, she's being, like, forceful and annoying, like, you know, you must be a serial killer because you're driving a van and you picked up a strange woman you don't know. And I found her to be very abrasive. So they finally get to the blacksmith's shop, and the guy, I think his name was Jerry or whatever, was welding up the jack for Uma Thurman, and they get back into the van and he drives her back to her car. And again, this whole time she's saying, you know, you could be a serial killer, I could just take you and or you could take me anywhere and nobody would be the wiser. And then she says, but actually you screwed up because Jerry the blacksmith saw us together and now he knows that, you know, I was the last person that you were seen with. So they get back to her car and she doesn't want to work on her flat tires, so she pretty much like goads him into fixing the tire for her and the jack breaks again. So now they get back into Jack's van. And they start driving into town again. And now she's to the point where she's saying, you know, hey, you could just take this jack and, like, kill me with it. And I think, you know, something in Jack's head snaps. And he, you see him pick up the jack and he smacks her in the head with it. Or, like, right in the face.
Also, I'm sorry for joining in. But it was also in that scene where she was talking about, you can just hit me right now, kill me. And it was kind of between the... images or videos of the tiger and the lamb.
Yes.
And then, you know, that poem was talked about later on when we get there.
Yeah. So, yeah, Jack hits Uma Thurman, or Lady One, in the face with the broken jack that was sitting in between the two seats. And as Tyler said, you know, there's intercut with a lion and a tiger and a lamb. And then it cuts to her kind of sitting in the front seat of the van, and her face is just mangled, like it's dented, and, I mean, pretty cool, sweet, lovely effects. I love that kind of graphic effects. And then, so he turns back around, he goes to her car, he ultimately ends up fixing it because he drives it off the road, and then he makes a comment to himself that, you know, he got lucky because... The little bridge that he rode over with the little creek running underneath or a little stream was the state line. So technically, police in his state can't look over or can't see, in quotes, over the state line, which is so basically means that they're out of his jurisdiction. And then he tosses her car keys into the little stream and walks off. I don't know, just it kind of gives you a look into his mind. Into his psyche, and I think the whole movie is an allegory for serial killers in general. I don't know if you do any true crime kind of stuff, but you always hear stories that, you know, killers in the beginning are very sloppy, and, you know, they don't know what they're doing, they're trying to figure it out. Like Ted Bundy specifically said, you know, he built a kit based around how he decided he was going to kill. But there was one point where he didn't have the tool he needed, so he moved on from that victim. You know what I mean?
Or even sometimes, you know, serial killers, well, before they even become serial killers, they kill on accident. And then they're like, oh, well, that actually felt good.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they move on from there.
Well, right. And you know, Jeffrey Dahmer. It's like he tried to perfect his, not so much the kill, but the preservation of the bodies and stuff like that. So I think the whole movie is almost like, and as the movie progresses, you follow Matt Damon's character. And I mean, you do learn here in just a minute that he has OCD, but he, as the movie progresses, he gets smarter about what he does. But then he gets to a point where he says it several times, I don't care. You know, he says, I don't care anymore. I want to get caught. It's almost like he's tired of it, you know?
It's like a game of cat and mouse. Eventually, you know, you run away for so long, you just want the thrill of getting caught.
Yeah, essentially. Yeah. So, exactly. He wants to get caught, or at least he wants to get chased. And I almost think, and I'll mention it again later, but at the very end, before his house is actually built, that may be why he leaves the siren on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, now we get another title card, Incident 2. He's sitting in his van again. And as the incidents go on, there's two really rough ones, and then there's some that are kind of, you know, so-so. He's sitting in his van again, and he sees a lady walking down the street, and she's carrying groceries with her. And he follows, and this part is kind of funny. I don't know if you feel the same way, but...
I thought the whole incident was funny.
Okay, good. So then
from the beginning when he's trying to enter, and then the end when he's leaving.
Okay, so, all right, we're on the same page then. So he goes up to this lady's house, and he's trying to convince her that he's a police officer because he wants to get into her house. She asks to see a badge, and he comes up with some bullshit story about how his badge is at the silversmith because it's getting polished and it's getting more commendations put on it and stuff like that. And the lady...
Get a promotion.
Yeah, oh, you're right. He got a promotion. He's not at liberty to say what it is, but it's a big step up the ladder is what he describes it as. So he's trying to convince her to get into the house, and she keeps saying no, 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 no. He spies a picture on the wall of her ex-husband working on, like, the railroad or something like that. And he says, you know, I can call people down at the station and we can get a bump in your pension. Yeah. And so she immediately kind of lightens up a little bit. And then she says something more about how, you know, she still needs to see a badge. And then he says, okay. He says, all right, you got me. He goes, you know, I'm not a cop, but I'm an insurance agent. And just as he says that, one of her neighbors goes driving by, and she waves at him, and she says, oh, that's Glenn. And he goes, yeah, you know. And he turns around and he waves, and, hey, Glenn, you know, like he knew who it was when clearly he was just, again, bullshitting her. So, and like you said, the whole interaction between them is very awkward, and, again, like he's trying to learn how to act to his victims, or to everybody, essentially. She finally allows him to go into the house. She offers him up some tea, and as she's walking away towards the kitchen, he comes up behind her and he starts strangling her. And they fall over, and she, you know, he's like in pain because he landed on the corner of a table or something like that. And she gets up and goes back in towards the kitchen, and he comes behind her and he starts strangling her again. Now, when they fall over for the second time, she's like choking, and did he break her neck, or that was the only part I didn't understand about it.
He was suffocating her, and at first she lost consciousness. You know, a couple minutes later, she's like gagging her. Her windpipe, I guess you'd say, is damaged. She starts struggling again.
Right. Right. Okay. So it probably wasn't broken. Probably just her windpipe was crushed. Is what you're thinking?
That's what I'm thinking. I'm not a doctor, but that's just my guess.
Right. No, that's fine. So, right, as Tyler says, after she wakes up, she's like hacking and trying to breathe. He immediately starts apologizing to her, like, you know, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to do that. Or, again, just very awkward and strange interaction between these two characters.
Yeah, he was almost like kind of regretting, you know, trying to kill her in the first place.
Right. It does kind of seem like it. Because, you know, he's apologizing, and then he offers her up a donut and some chamomile tea, that he's brought with him. And he's trying to, like, you know, feed it to her, and she starts hacking again. So he gets up to do something, and she starts trying to, like, get up, you know, even farther, or, like, sit upright. and he pulls a knife out of his a sheath, like on his ankle, and he's like, you can see him, and he's kind of feeling down her chest to like find out where her breastbone is, or like where the solar plexus or something is. And he just takes it and he jams it into her chest, pulls it out immediately, and there's a couple cool squirts of blood. And it's already at this point that you can hear the cop car coming, correct?
And he starts, you know, cleaning up everything a little bit. It was, the cops don't come in until he keeps on going back and forth cleaning everything, because he's, you know, again, he's OCD at this point.
Right.
He wraps up the body in, some kind of plastic, and he, like, tosses it in the back of his van, and he's busy cleaning, scrubbing the walls, even though, I didn't see anything on the walls.
No.
Scrubbing underneath the couch, the chair, he was just scrubbing everything down. He goes back in, starts up the van, then he starts having visions of, like, he lifts up the painting and there's blood on the wall. Then he goes back in, double checks, triple checks.
Yeah, a few times.
It was like the third time when he just finally gives up, and then the cops are, you know, in the distance, and he's like, if I drive off, you know, they're going to pull me over anyway.
Right. So, yeah, the cop pulls up, and you don't see it at this point, but he's hid the body in the bushes next to him. So, again, he does some bullshit story to the cop about how he was supposed to get some magazines from her husband.
It was an old railroad track from when they were working on the railroads.
Oh.
Like a made up a BS story how he was a collector or enthusiast for railroad tracks.
Right. So, and he follows the cop in, and he's trying to explain to the cop that, you know, the house must be investigated with a magnifying glass, because he's a really good actor, and he's really got like a two sides to the coin kind of thing. He can turn off his humor and his seriousness, you know, just like that. The cop finally pulls away, or no, I'm sorry. The cop is inside, like he called in somebody else, and Matt Dillon or Jack waits for him to leave, or leave the window, because he's looking out at Jack. He hurries up and he grabs a rope from the bushes where the body was, and I think it was a shower curtain that she was wrapped up in, but he ties it to the back of his van real quick and pulls off, and the I love this. The body is dragging behind him for who knows how far, and he ends up getting back to his little freezer. You find out he's got, like, a freezer.
It's on some street that no one knows the name, because the
sign
is broken.
Yeah, the sign
is
broken.
No one knows it's really there.
And so he gets back, and he pulls the body, or he discovers that there was a trail of blood, you know, basically from the house to this freezer, and again there's more voiceovers, and then the great rain comes and washes away all the blood, and he actually does say it, I think, is that he was disappointed kinda because the rain washed away the blood, and that, you know, he kinda wanted to get discovered. So he takes the body into the freezer and he unwraps it, and literally like half the body is shaved off because it was dragging behind him.
I think like her face was just bone at that point.
So, and it's just, you know, it was just kind of funny because, I don't know, I'm weird that way. So I thought it was funny. And then he explains why he has the freezer. He bought it off of somebody, like a restaurant owner, and he had a bunch of pizzas left over in there, and he tried to see, he only sold like two of the, what, probably 200 pizzas, because they tasted like shit or something like that, is what he says. So,
it's like one of those stereotypical, you know, frozen pizzas you get at the supermarket.
Yeah, I think it was Tito's or Tony's or something like that. But and then you see Jack, he's studying facial expressions of, like, cutout pictures in magazines. He's got them plastered all over his mirror or whatever. And again, he's explaining that, you know, in order to blend in, he needs to be able to act and react like a normal human being. So he goes through, you know, a smile and then disappointment and then anger and then embarrassment and stuff like that. And you see him looking at these pictures, and then you see his reflection in the mirror, and he's doing all these things, and it's like, when he was trying to, I think it was the embarrassment, like, he was acting embarrassed, or it's kind of like the snake eating its tail. He was trying to play a sociopath who has no emotions, playing somebody who has emotions, and it's the way he comes off with the goofy, awkward smile and stuff like that. I don't know, he's really good in this movie, I know that.
Definitely, like trying to fake someone who's trying to fake emotions.
Yeah, exactly. And so he's going through all these emotions, and then as he's doing this, and of course now he's giving another voiceover, and we should say that, like, half the time there's the voiceovers, there's also the character Verge, who you never see until the end. And he's, you know, he's talking back and forth with Verge, and as Tyler mentioned, you know, some of it's about art, and some of it's about the life and death cycle, and some of it's about, you know, the tiger and the lamb, or the lion and the lamb, or just all sorts of shit. I mean, it's a very, again, Von Trier is very artsy in, you know, the way he does things and puts them together with the intercut hidden meanings and stuff like that. So then we get a flashback to him as a boy. He's sitting on a dock and he's kind of watching the, I guess, farmers or whatever you would consider them. And they're scything the weeds or the, you know, in some field. And you hear a little duckling swimming in the water, and he puts a net into the water, he pulls the duckling out, picks it up, and he actually cuts one of the legs off the duckling, and then just tosses it back into the water to watch it struggle and squirm. Now, one thing I did hear is that PETA actually was okay with that. Of all people, PETA, or all entities, I guess.
I actually didn't research that. Kind of surprised by that. I mean, you think PETA would want, you know, that thing shut down, but...
Well, I think it was a mechanical duck, but I think the way he went about doing it, something about PETA, I know that. I read it, but I didn't write it down, so... And that's just, you know, it's one of those things that showing, even way back in his youth, that he was a sociopath and didn't care. You know, and one of the things that is often said about serial killers is that when they're young, they will hurt animals just for pleasure. Hard cut to him strangling another woman. There's another voiceover of Jack, and he says, experience has taught me how to strangle correctly and for long enough. So we get the point that Jack is progressing as a murderer. He takes this body to the freezer. And then you see him developing pictures, but he doesn't like the pictures that he has developed. He doesn't think they're artistic enough.
Have to deal with the coloration of the pictures, the negative of the pictures, because it's like a Polaroid camera, I believe. Or is it some sort of special camera and it was developing like a, well, I don't know what you call it.
He was developing the pictures himself, and he did have a film strip, so... The pictures that he was looking at were on, like, actual camera film. He had a little dark room in his, either at his house or at the freezer. But he goes back to... he's unhappy with the pictures, so he starts driving back to get the body that he has already killed, or just killed. As he's going back, he sees a woman walking down the side of the street. There's another car passing at the same time he is, and he gets, you know, 100 yards down the road or whatever, and he starts getting pissed off because, well, you come to find out he gets pissed off that he couldn't kill this woman too. So he immediately swings back around and he just mows her over. You know, he runs her down, and then he takes both bodies back to where he killed the original. And he starts taking pictures of them.
Start doing poses or something.
Yeah. He poses them on, I guess it was a futon or a couch or whatever. And then you see him develop these pictures. And then he leaves one of the pictures for the cops. And on it, he writes, Mr. Sophistication. And then that's it. That's it for that scene. Now we go to our third incident. And this one's tough if you've got kids. Yeah, obviously you're 19. Yeah. I would assume you don't have any children yet.
No, no, I don't. Okay. I would never let them watch this until they're 18 plus.
All right. So we have five kids. Our youngest will actually be 9 tomorrow. So the kids in this show, in this scene, are a little bit younger than ours, but he takes a mom and her two kids. One is named Georgie, and one he's nicknamed Grumpy because the kid never smiles and he doesn't seem to be happy. And he takes them out into like almost a forest area, or like an open field with forest surrounding it. And he's explaining to the one...
He had a target set out as like they had a watchtower out, and they had targets set out as like a open forest shooting range almost.
Right. So he's explaining to the kids, and I guess the mother, about how, you know, you need to hunt, you need to do this, and whatever. He has the one boy come up to the tower with him, and they shoot at the target, and he's, you know, makes more speech about killing and culling and trapping and all that kind of stuff. And then there's a hard cut to both of the boys and the mother kind of cowering in fear behind like a giant pushed over tree stump or something. One of the things that he was saying, and did you understand this? Maybe I missed the point of it, but...
I believe I understood that he was talking about the order. He's comparing the family to deer and the order you have to kill the deer.
Okay.
I believe, if I remember correctly in the film, it was the oldest child, then the youngest, then the mother. I believe that was the order.
Okay.
I don't remember the reasoning behind it, but it just had to do with order.
Okay. Yeah, I remember now that you say it. Because if you kill the mother first, there's a chance, or of the deer anyway, if you kill the mother first, both of the fawns will probably end up dying because they don't have anything to take care of them. But if you kill the youngest, then the mother still has the older male and herself, and then you kill the second oldest, and then you kill the mother. That way... You know, they there's like an order to the killing, so animals don't die unnecessarily if you were hunting, you know, actual animals. But so he ends up shooting the first son in the leg, and you can kind of, I mean, you see the kid go down, but you don't really see the aftermath of it for a few minutes. But you come to learn because the mother runs out to get the youngest, who's dead on the ground. I assume he had to have bled out. So the mother runs out, and then the middle kid pokes his head up over a tree stump.
Shot in the head, yeah.
Yeah, gets just shot in the head. So he's being shot.
I don't know which, you probably watched the theatrical cut, I'm assuming.
Mine wasn't the director.
The director's cut is, though it doesn't add like more than a minute, but it's like when Jack shot the kid in the leg, you actually saw the leg, you know, snap off.
Okay.
But then you actually showed the kid being shot in the head, and I don't know, at that point, I was just like, oh my gosh.
Well, yeah, because you hear the gunshot towards the head, and then it immediately cuts, so you don't see his actual... I mean, because he's being shot with a 30-06, that would just obliterate his head. So then the mother starts screaming, and now they're having a picnic, which is, and Matt Damon is going about talking about how, you know, when he was younger, he never got pie, so she should feed the kids pie, and keeping in mind that both of the children are dead. And then he asked her what her favorite number is, and she says 12. And now, I had seen this when it first came out, but, you know, if somebody had just killed both of your children and then asks you what your favorite number is, I would give a hell of a lot higher number than 12, because I would know that he was just going to count to 12 to give you that far of a giveaway or getaway, you know.
Hope you can count to a million.
Yeah, right. You know, I mean, hell, at least give like, you know, 69 or something like that. Of course, I mean, you know, being a male, that would be my favorite number, but so, you know, at least you'd get like a quarter of a mile away or something, and I sure as hell wouldn't walk. I would be out of there, you know, like straight away. So anyway, he ends up shooting her. She gets, like, starts hiding into a little trench or something, and then he walks up to her, shoots her in the back, and then all three of them are dead.
And now, during that scene with the mother, because he shot her once while he's in the watchtower while he's counting.
Right.
And then he's, you know, during all the scenes, there's, like, interloops of him describing, you know, whatever. He was, like, following her blood trail, and he was describing, Schweiss is, the term for blood in German, you know, Schweisshound, and so he's tracking the blood trail. And I just found that was interesting about the movie. Just, we're getting, like, a history lesson between all these scenes.
And it's, again, that's, you know, the artsiness of it. And I'm surprised, people hated this movie because they thought it was, like, ultra-violent. I've seen a lot worse movies than this in terms of violence. But maybe because it was so artsy as well, they, you know, I don't know. But it is a good movie. So then we get to the fourth incident. Oh, wait, I forgot. Is it at this point where he's doing the taxidermy with Grumpy?
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's back in the freezer, and he starts taxidermying Grumpy, and he's making him wave, and he puts a really, like, disturbing smile on his face, like he had bent wires. So he actually inserted it inside Grumpy's mouth, so Grumpy is actually waving and smiling now. And
when I saw that, I was like, oh, God.
Yeah, it gets hard at some points, but artsy, like... hard artsy, I guess. I don't know.
I understood the message in the meeting, but I just thought that whole scenario part was just... like, I don't even have kids myself, but I thought that was kind of unbearable at times.
It was. I mean, I... you know, like I said, my kids are, well, 9, which is probably almost about the age that Georgie was, but I could tell because it was... I mean, obviously, it's a movie and it's make-believe, but... you know, but it was tough, but at the same time, it was like, you know, I'm good with it. So, or not good with it, but you know what I mean. So anyway, we go to the fourth incident, and this one was also kind of funny and a little kind of rough, too. He meets up with a blonde girl. I didn't really, I guess they're dating, maybe, because she is constantly saying to him, you know, why are you always so crude? Why are you always so...
it's like the abusive boyfriend.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like she doesn't want to talk at first, but then he's got this, like, toy phone or something. So he goes into one room of their apartment, and she's in another, and he calls her up. I don't know. They're like, talking over this toy phone. But at the same time, he's calling her simple and stupid, and he acts rude, and he tells her, you know... and, like, he, again, immediately, like, flips a coin. At first, he's kind of soft and soothing. And then he flips and he says, you know, I've killed 60 people. You could be number 61 in just a matter of minutes. But then he asks her for a marker. He pulls her boobies out and he starts, like, drawing, like, cut lines on, like, around her boobies. Like, dash marks or hash lines or whatever.
Yeah, like, for surgeries. Surgeons usually do that.
Yeah, exactly. So he's filling her up. He's drawing these lines on her boobies. He makes a couple more, you know, crude comments. And then she runs out of the apartment and down to a cop that was sitting in the street. And she starts telling him, you know, oh, my boyfriend says he's killed, you know, 60 people. And he says, you know, ma'am, have you been drinking? And she's like, well, you know, yeah. And so Jack comes down and he says, officer, everything she said is true. I've killed 60 people and da 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 da, you know. And the cop just says, all right. He goes, I can't tell you to stop drinking, but he goes, I would strongly recommend that you do and go back upstairs. So the cop pulls off and then Jack falls asleep on the couch, or at least you think he does. And Simple, or I think her real name was what, Jacqueline?
Jacqueline.
Yeah, okay. So, or Jacqueline, or Simple, goes to make a phone call because she says she wants to get some pills. She picks up the phone and there's no dial tone. Well, she pulls the cord and, of course, the phone line had been cut. So she kind of creeps towards the front door to try and escape or at least get out and do something. And Jack stands up behind her, like, immediately pounces on her and is awake. Well, he binds her up with the phone cord and gags her mouth. And then he says, you know, you got, like, three or four knives here. He goes, I'm going to lay them all out. You choose the one you want me to use. And he goes to town, or I think he goes through one or two of the knives and kind of forces her to pick the knife because he's shaking her head yes or no. And then it kind of cut, or you kind of hear almost like a sawing sound, kind of, sort of. And she starts screaming through the gag. And then the scene cuts. Or no, that's right. He walks out of the apartment again, and there's a cop outside.
Yeah, the cop car is busy on the street talking to some other group, and then he just takes the tit and just slaps on his windshield and then runs off.
Yeah, he just slaps one of the cut-off boobs on the cop's windshield. And then, yeah, hightails it out of there. And then this is where we get the big montage of, not, like, you know, more art stuff and more, you know, the lights and the shadows and the, you know, and, you know, interspliced with clips of Lars von Trier's other movies.
The movie definitely contained tons of metaphors. Too much for me to remember, but yeah, there was quite a bit of different metaphors and meanings in this one.
It's so weird, but I don't, you know, well, you did see, don't remember the movie, she's giving birth to an adult. I do not remember what movie that was from of his, but so I guess technically, the Green Goblin, from Antichrist, Willem Dafoe makes a cameo, kind of, sort of ish, because they do show a clip of Antichrist with him in it. And
it's his nuts smashed by that cinder block.
It was not, yeah. That was a rough movie. Not as bad as a lot of people made it out to be, but not good either. So now we get to the fifth I forgot. Jack goes to buy ammo from a weapon store. And as he's talking to the clerk at the ammo store, he's, like, digging through this coin purse. And again, in the voiceover, he says, you know, Simple's other tit didn't go to waste. He made a coin purse out of it. So he's preserved it, and he's been using it as a coin purse. So he's carrying around his change and his money and a preserved boob, hollowed out boob. Now we get to the fifth incident. There's a black man in the back of Jack's van, and he's taken into the freezer. And there's several other men tied to, like, a bar or a pole or something, like...
It was, like, two bars, and it was, like, holding their necks in so they can move their body. Well, I mean, of course, they were tied up, but, like, if they try to, you know, yank at their neck, they'd be choked by the two bars in between.
Right. And
I think he described it as, like, some, I don't remember what war, but it was, like, a war tactic, torture method where, going earlier, we'll learn he bought the ammo because he had a sniper and he was going to have a full metal jacket bullet go through all their heads.
Right. I think it was World War II because they were executing so many people that they were running low on ammo, so they tried to figure out the best way to do multiples at once. So they would line them up and shoot like three or four of them at a time, and that's what he was trying to discover if he could do. The black guy that he had just taken out of the van turns out was a military vet, and he says the bullet that Jack has was not a full metal jacket, so Jack leaves to get the correct ammo, and he goes back to the ammo store, and the clerk is acting all weird, you know, asking for a receipt, asking for his ID, asking for all, you know, just basically just acting really kind of squirrely. So, you know, Jack finally says, just, you know, fuck it. I'm out of here. You know, fuck you. Keep your bullets, because they were mislabeled is what was going on. Jack goes to another trailer, apparently of a place that he's bought ammo before. And SP is the guy's name, tells Jack that the cops are on to him because they had been to, it's Al. Al's ammo store and SP's house just the other day looking for Jack. Which it kind of makes me wonder... And this is going all the way back to incident 2. Jack is in the house and he's strangling this woman, and then he's touching everything, cleaning it up, but he's not wearing gloves this entire time, and he's literally touching everything. You know, the lamps, the floor, the everything, the cleaners even under the kitchen sink, but he's not wearing gloves, so his fingerprints are all over that house.
And now, even then, the cop who saw him, they'd be like, hey, I saw this guy, let's, you know, match your description on him.
And that very well could be it, you know. But and they don't really give a time, like a time period for the movie. But all the cars are a little bit older. But then, like, the things that he's doing, I don't know. It's just, it's kind of weird. Again, we go back to this artsy-fartsy bullshit. But anyway, so Jack and SP now, or SP tells him that, you know, the cops are on to him. So they start kind of shooting the shit and talking about really nothing. And SP goes to pour a drink of whiskey or something. And as he's bringing the drink over to Jack, Jack stands up real quick and stabs him under the chin. He goes into like a closet and gets the FMJ that he was looking for originally. The cops come tearing up in their cop car. Sirens blaring, guns drawn. This whole time, SP was wearing a red robe, which I think is probably symbolism for something, but I don't know for sure.
I didn't know that one either.
Okay. So, SP's dead laying on the floor, and Jack is in this red robe standing over the body on the floor. Well, they think Jack is SP and SP is Jack. So, the cop turns around, or the cop is there, gun drawn. And, you know, he says to who he thinks is SP, oh, great, you got him. You know, we'll take it from here. Well, Jack turns around and puts four or five bullets into the cop. And then Jack tears off in the cop car, sirens wailing. And as we talked about before, briefly, Jack is back in the freezer and he's still in the cop car. The sirens are blaring this entire time. He can't focus the rifle scope because he's too close to the bodies that he had tied up, or, you know, the heads of the men. There's an extra room inside the freezer that this whole time Jack has been trying to open, but he couldn't get it open. And I don't really understand why he was able to this time as compared to every other time.
Yeah, they kind of BS'd the reason. You put like a bar around it and use leverage, but yeah.
So he finally gets the door open to this extra room that for some reason he was never able to open before. And he moves his rifle back a little bit into the empty room. And then you hear somebody speaking to Jack. And he says, Jack, Jack, you know. And it turns out that Verge, who was the voice that Jack was talking to this whole time, is inside the room that had never been opened. Now, okay, I said, in my notes, I've got it written down. Who is Verge besides a spirit or Jack's conscious? But then as you go on, and I think we're close enough now, I think Verge is the river man to the river Styx. Is that kind of what you picked up from that? Or the ferryman?
No, I did not pick up that, but that is like another good, I guess you'd say, version of it. I don't know if you haven't read The Divine Comedy by Dante Alighieri.
I have not.
Basically, it's broken up into three parts, Inferno, Purgatory, and Heaven. I forgot, it's not called Heaven, but it's, the last part is basically Heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, Dante Alighieri wrote a book about himself where he starts on Inferno, where he's walking in the woods and stumbles upon the ghost of Virgil, who happens to be a famous poet of sorts.
Okay.
And apparently, Dante's been sinning, or I don't think it described what exactly he sinned for, but Virgil is like, listen, you're going on the wrong path, let me show you the way you're going, and maybe you might change your mind and, you know, go for a redemption to heaven. So the whole first part of the Divine Comedy is just Virgil leading Dante through, I think it was the 8 circles of hell.
Okay.
Basically showing him each circle. And Dante's like, oh, no, don't want to be here.
Okay, so then, well, because
the second part is Purgatory and works his way up to heaven.
Huh, okay. Yeah, no, I've never read that. All right. Well, that changes things. Okay, so Yeah, Verge is inside this room, and he tells Jack that he never built his house, but he says that he can now. And I guess we should say that this throughout this entire movie, it shows Jack drawing and designing and building models of houses, and then he apparently owns property out by a lake that he wants to build the house that he's designed. And he gets so far in the house building aspect of it, and then he has the house torn down and he starts over with a new design. Well, so Verge now tells him, hey, you know, you can build the house that you wanted to this whole time, and he says, you've got the materials right here. So what does Jack do? He ends up building a literal house out of the dead and frozen bodies from the freezer. And as he's doing this, the cops are cutting through the freezer door and they start shooting. And Verge says, hey, you know, are you going to follow me? And he jumps into a hole in the floor and Jack follows him in. And then you get the epilogue, which is also titled Katabasis or Katabasis. Which is, and this one I did look up, which is ancient Greek, and it means to descend to the underworld. Jack is now standing in water, and then there's a shot of Jack and Verge, like dead man floating under ice. So you kind of have to assume that when the cops were shooting in through the little hole in the door, that Jack was actually hit and got killed. At least that's my assumption on it. They start walking through this flooded cabin, and I got to give credit to the old man, Verge. I mean, if that was an actual, like, cabin or cavern, like, underground, the dude was doing pretty good. And you know, Verge is kind of an older man.
I like the whole shot that they used for the cavern. That was sort of like a POV movie.
Yeah. It was almost like, I mean, you know, Katabasis is the descent into the underworld, and it's almost like the way they shot it was like the movie Descent. You know, you see, like you said, the POV, and it's just, it's lit up, but like, yeah, they're traversing this underground cavern that's half flooded with water. You hear this buzzing constantly in the background, and Jack says, you know, what is that noise? He says, I can't hardly stand it. And Verge explains to him that it's the sound of millions of dead and suffering. And when they are all screaming together, it almost creates like a buzzing noise. And this is kind of what led me to believe that Verge was like the ferryman of the River Styx. You get more of the artsy-fartsy Von Trier shit, and they're still walking through, and I, you know, this it's so weird because like, time has slowed down. You get a shot of Jack and Verge after they're doing the dead man float. Then you see them standing in like bubbles underwater and they're like falling down a cavern or something. And then there's another shot.
It's like a windmill when they're watching the people slicing outside.
Yeah. And then did I already miss it? I must have missed it. But the shot with the nude bodies like holding Jack and Verge up on a...
Forgot about that point.
Yeah, and like, you know, there's naked men and women and they're holding like a boat and they're in water and Jack and Verge are on the boat. It's very goofy. So,
and that goes back to the Divine Comedy, the first part, Inferno, because like each different scene is like a certain circle of hell.
Okay, so yeah. So they're walking through the bloody rooms, they're being hoisted by nudes in the water. They're standing, like you said, in a farmhouse with the windmill, and you can hear the scything again. And Verge says that it's the Elysian Fields, which is where the Greek heroes were sent after death, and it's kind of like a paradise land. And then Verge takes Jack to the lowest level of hell, where there's a giant river of fire, a never-ending pit into, well, hell. And then there's a broken bridge, and Jack says, you know, what... Where does that path lead? You know, to the other side of the bridge, because there's like a stairway leading up. And Verge says, well, that leads out of hell and up back to either earth or heaven or whatever. And I don't even know how you would describe this. Like, where they're standing, they're on the broken bridge, but it's like a giant, like, circular pit.
Yeah, like the whole room was circular, and then I guess like the walls were jagged, so Jack thought, hey, I could probably, you know, rock climb around the room and get to the other side.
Right, and Virge says, well, many have tried, but none have ever succeeded. So Virge leaves, Jack starts climbing around the outside of the circular pit, and he falls into the never-ending pit and dies. Again, I guess. So Jack is dead now, and then credits roll. Okay, what a weird trip.
Definitely. Went from typical serial killer in, I guess, different segments. You know, there's a lot in between that we don't know. And then that whole ending was just something else.
Yeah, you know, I haven't seen many of Von Trier's movies. I mean, I've seen Antichrist, and I've seen bits and pieces of the Melancholia. And he has a very distinct style, obviously. You know, and the way he does things, like with his storytelling and, you know, the visuals and stuff like that, you can tell it's his movie when you see it, even if you didn't know it. I don't know, man. So, all right. If you've listened to our podcast before, we do what we call the gore score. So out of 10, I mean, the gore score covers gore and violence. So out of 10, what would you give this movie on that?
Honestly, if you're talking about director's cut, it does put a couple extra seconds of visual gore.
Okay.
Probably I'd give it a 7.5.
Okay. All right. That's fair. And then an overall score. Plot, acting, straight on down the line, what would you give that one out of 10?
Definitely thought this movie was slow, and
it doesn't.
I mean, I did enjoy it, but I can honestly say I can agree with people who didn't like it for the pacing, because it is a 2.5-hour movie.
Right.
But honestly, I did enjoy this movie throughout, and I did not have a problem with it at all, except just it was a little slow.
In some spots,
I honestly give this one a solid 8.
Okay, all right, that's fair. Yeah, I mean, I could definitely see that, and you know, I didn't see the director's cut, so I mean, what gore there was, I absolutely loved the idea of him dragging the body down the road, and it literally shaving the top half of its face off. I did not, however, see, you know, the kid get shot, but I think overall I would put this probably at about a 6. Now that might be bumped up a little bit if I saw the directors and it, you know, I saw the kid get his leg blown off.
We were talking about, I think it was the 4th incident where Simple gets her boot cut off and we actually see like cutting into the flesh, and I thought that was...
Oh. So yeah, that would definitely add another point to the score for sure. And then overall, I think, you know, I'd probably, like you said, it is a little slow in parts. But Matt Dillon's acting is like superb. You know, just his ability to fake emotion, his ability to turn on a dime from evil to good to goofy to, you know, sadistic and stuff like that, but his ability to turn on a dime and just and then, you know, his goofiness when he's trying to fake the emotions in front of the mirror, you know, while he's looking at the pictures. So yeah, I'd probably give it a 7.5. Would I recommend it? Yes, but you know, be aware that you're watching a 2.5-hour movie.
Not only that, but this is not a family-friendly movie at all. So.
No, it is not. But, I mean, yeah, you know, that's really all I got, unless you want to add anything else.
And then going back to the whole message of, you know, Jack's creating art out of his killing, so Virg is like, no, you're just killing. I think that goes back to Lars von Trier as a director and him making movies.
Mm-hmm.
Is that all of his movies are subjective, because, you know, you have people that like it and you have people that think that it's art in themselves, and then you just have that whole demographic of like, oh my gosh, this is disturbing, this is the worst thing I saw, you know, people should be able to make this, but, you know, we have free speech, so he has every right to make this.
Right.
So, Lars von Trier, as a director, his movies, which we can, well, I mean, they are art. Every movie's art. But, yeah, his movies are very subjective, just like the message he's trying to portray in The House That Jack Built.
Yeah, and you know, without looking at it too much, I gotta wonder, you know, what his true meaning behind it was. If it was, like, I don't know, there's so many different things that you can take away from the movie, because it just, I mean, there's so many different, like, subtle messages and hidden meanings, and it's just really weird.
I feel like everyone could get a different meaning out of it.
Yeah, you're probably right. And, you know, if you were to, this would be one of those good movies that to study for college. Pretty much any of his damn movies are, because they're so, again, I hate to keep saying it, but artsy. But they're all, like, really violent, too. Like, they're violent art. Of course, I mean, art throughout history has been, you know, pretty violent, too. So, I don't know, man. That's all I got, so.
Yeah, I feel like we pretty much covered everything.
All right.
A lot of digesting. I figured this is just one of those movies where you just have to watch it for yourself and come up with a verdict on yourself, for yourself.
And I think that's extremely fair to say, yeah. But why don't you, I mean, if you want to, you can go ahead and give yourself a shout, you know, on Instagram or whatever.
Okay, well, right now, I've been a little, haven't posted too much because of work and, you know, school. Mm-hmm. But when I do, I try to post reviews of recent horror movies that I watch. You know, try to give lengthy reviews instead of just a few sentences. I like to, I don't know if you read any of my posts all the way through, but I like to do, like, would I recommend it, would I watch it again? And I don't necessarily want to give movies a score, because people, when they look at a number score, you know, when people see like a 7 or 6, they think that's bad, but
yeah,
really it's not, because 5 is average.
Well, right.
But yeah, I base movies around on would I watch it again.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that's very fair. And it's obscure_horror, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So, yeah, this
and
is...
my profile pic is that little monster from Basket Case, if you ever seen that.
Oh, Belial.
Belial, yeah.
Yeah.
It's been a while since I saw that one.
All right. Well, you know, for not having ever done any podcasting, you did a fine job. I still struggle and stumble through, you know, my own damn show, and I've been doing it for a year and a half, so don't feel bad at all. But, yeah, I mean, you know...
I enjoyed it. I mean, thank you for inviting me, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you had a good time. And then, you know, maybe in the future we'll see an obscure horror podcast. You never know. But yeah, I mean, obviously if you're listening to this, you know where to find us. But Tyler, obscure_horror from Instagram, I thank you for being my second Insta guest on the Vile Movies That Made Us. Goreheads, be good to each other, and we'll talk to y'all later. So... bye, y'all.